You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, not today. We're not going to troll on in, but we are going to have a seat, and you're going to learn a whole bunch of stuff. It's like I was telling you, about a year ago, there was a climate training program that happened. It's part of NOAA, and as you know, so is the council part of NOAA. And to explain how that all works is Sylvia Spalding from the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. We have a good program coming up, and I ask you to stick around for the next few minutes and learn things about not just climate, but the planet, and how even it may not be so obvious how it fits into a big picture, it is. And these are what is called, something I learned, projections of risk and vulnerability to fisheries. And the minute we say fisheries, Sylvia, you and I light up. Who's trying to hurt our fisheries, or how can we help our fisheries? Tell us a little bit about, before we introduce our guest, tell us a little bit about how this is valuable to the fishery.
Well, the council has a marine planning and climate change committee because climate change has been on the horizon, and the administration, especially the Obama one beforehand, was concerned about it. And so, what our committee does is we look at the climate change that is occurring and how it might impact the fisheries.
And it does. I mean, it's kind of funny. Some of this is anecdotal, and we'll go around the inshore fishery a little bit to point out some things. But some of it is there's no more fish in the ocean. Yeah, they are. They're just not where you think they are. They're someplace else.
That's true, especially we've noticed. So I think you had Malloy on before about our annual reports. And in our annual reports since 2015, we've included a climate component to it, mm-hmm. to see how climate might be affecting the fisheries. And like one thing that we've noticed is like the big eye, the 300 meter depth where they like to fish, mm-hmm. and where the fish are found, has kind of been moving north. Other things is degree heating week. It seems like there's a lot of terms that the climatologists use that, fishermen maybe are just getting to know what they are. One is degree heating week is how many weeks is the temperature, sea surface temperature, higher than normal. And that really impacts coral bleaching.
Sure, sure.
So if you're a coral reef fisherman, that would impact you.
I think it's incredibly interesting because, there's a big picture. And a lot of times here when we do it, and we're specifically talking about the local, and this is not just here, but CNMI in Samoa and Guam and a lot of other places where we get community-based management for the fishery. And they're looking at a real small little part of the globe, and sometimes it's really good for them to know that while there's a lot of scientific data that can help them sort of explain what's happening in their little reef based on the big picture.
Right. So we're using the NOAA scientists are helping us here, and you'll introduce our guest in a minute. But they use like satellite information. But a lot of times the information is on the larger scale. Mm-hmm. So it is important to get the localized data also.
You know what I've sometimes compared this to? You and I might be worried about what's for lunch, and some of the scientists might be worried about what's for lunch in 200 years. In other words, they got to take a little look a little further down the road than some of us do.
Right. Yeah. So, when we deal with climate, we're talking about in the future. I've heard the figure 30 years is climate, whereas weather is like today and tomorrow. But we can talk more about the definition.
And I want to do that. Now, that means it's a perfect time to segue in to introduce you to John Mara. He's a PhD. Dr. Mara is the original Climate Services Director for the Pacific region of NOAA, National Center for Environmental Information. So is actually the title wraps around your business card twice.
There we go.
Nice to see you, John. Thanks very much for joining us.
Aloha.
We don't want to say that we're at the tail being wagged by the dog, but in many respects, I'm thinking that some of the things we're going to learn from you are something when Sylvia just said something should sink in on something. Weather and climate. Weather is today, climate's like over a long period of time. Is that good? Is that a good definition?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what we're talking about. Yeah. I mean, I've heard people talk about it like you can think of it a little bit like a iTunes playlist in that, if you have one jazz music, that's kind of the climate, the basic type. But then any particular song is the weather. That's what's happened on any day to day.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So I don't know if that's a great analogy.
No, that's a good analogy.
You're talking about any given day, it can be warm, but it's warm or cold. But what's that day look like on average?
I'm thinking that there must be a couple of things in your business that make what you do gratifying, in that you provide a huge piece of work that people have got to interpret, that have no idea what you're doing, but they really don't. I don't know if they care what you're doing. They just want to know how it's going to affect them. What can your study show me about how it's going to affect me and what I do?
Well, I guess if when we say you and what you do, or are we talking fish specifically?
We're talking about a guy out there that's listening right now in Kulio'o on Oahu, and he's got a trailer boat and he wants to go fishing, wants to know.
Well, there's a couple different things, because we talk about, I don't like to use the word climate change. I like to use changing climate, because there's really a couple different pieces to it.
Okay.
We were talking earlier. There's sort of climate variability. In other words, there's natural patterns of change, and then there's the long-term trend, and that's the change per se. So the climate variability piece, but the most common, well-known thing is El Nino and La Nina.
Sure.
That can be important, because when it looks like right now we're in an El Nino watch, so we might have an El Nino coming about this December, January. It means it's going to be drier. It means there's probably less wind, so maybe it's not so hard to take the boat out. It means that probably higher likelihood of hurricanes. It also means that higher sea surface temperature, so it's not great for the reef.
Yep.
So even on that sort of short, La Nina is kind of the other way around. You had different things, more rain. So even on the short term, it gives you some sense of like, oh, what's this season going to be like? Similar to the fish move in different places up and down, depending on whether El Nino or La Nina.
Yeah,
that's the sort of short
term. That's great. That's a great way to explain it. And I think mainly, and Sylvia, maybe you can agree that, you know, for instance, when we're at, doing one of the many things during the three at least annual meetings of the council, part of the Fisheries Forum that I've been happy to be a part of for the last several years, is people come with really small expectations. They just want to know what's happening in Kula, you know, and yet I think they need to know, if they go to wpcouncil.org, there's this kind of information is available that is fascinating.
Right. And like I said, again, they really want to find out like what 2017 is like. They can go to our annual reports, which is under our publications tab, because we just put those up, and we're going to have a brochure that have the highlights on it soon. But like I said, there's that climate chapter. So if they want to look at last year, and we're just starting to try to get toward predictions, but maybe John can talk more about that.
And John, maybe there's another point too. And it's a little easier to understand for, say, farmers that get the almanac and they look forward every year. No, let's not even plant next year. It's not a good idea, because we're not going to get the rain we need. I'm not sure that the fishery acts the same way, because we're kind of supply and demand. The fisherman's got the pressure to go catch fish, but he might not catch them in the same place or as many based on the kind of information he can learn.
Right. And we're talking, so like you're suggesting, we kind of have two pieces. One is that, what's it going to be like the next few months or the next season? And then there's also the issue of like, what's it going to be like 10 years down the line? That's the change piece.
And
that's another, so you're planning for, even if you're a recreational fishing operator, that's a certain thing you need to think about. If we start losing reef fish, well then...
Yeah, where am I going to take my customers?
Exactly. Yeah. I got to find someplace else to fish.
You know, there's another thing, and I don't know if this is just coincidental. I don't know if either one of you have seen this, but just the other day, I think in the Star Advertiser, I saw where there, I think it was in Argentina, when this new prehistoric animal was found, the skeleton of a monster dinosaur. And it said it was from 300 million years ago. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. You know, the 7 days of creation thing is sort of over a much longer period of time. And I'm sort of thinking that maybe in the big picture, if we can accept that, we can accept that certain things we can control and certain things we can't. Does your world agree with that? With respect to, I mean, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, the weather's going to be what the weather is, or are we affected? Are we affecting it? My guess is we're affecting it.
Yeah, I think we've been, burning fossil fuel, basically driving cars and having light bulbs and hot water and eating hamburgers and doing those sorts of things. And they increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
It's funny, because when we say that now, we say fossil fuels and I'm not sure whether they're from fossils. I mean, you know, what we're talking about is this stuff that's in the you know, under the surface,
right,
that is vegetable, animal, mineral matter that's all in this big sludgy mess called oil.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you can even step back from my perspective. It doesn't matter necessarily exactly where it's from, but if you look at what we've seen, observed, you go out to Mauna Loa. We've been measuring carbon dioxide concentrations out there since 59. It's like the premier place in the whole world.
In the world, right?
In the world. In 59, I think it was 315 parts per million. Right now, we're looking at 410 parts per million. So, you know, I'm not even going to worry about what's causing it. What I can measure is the fact that, you know what, it's gone up almost 100 parts per million in, what, 60 years.
And so if we don't make some changes, it's going to be predictable. It gets exponential after a while.
Yeah. Right now it's at 400. It hasn't, you're talking about the dinosaur. Well, it wasn't that long, but it hasn't been 400 parts per million for probably three to five million years.
Yeah. Ooh.
And the pace that we're going, at the current rate, it'll probably be double that within the next 50, 60 years, and it hasn't been double that for about 35 million years ago, 30, 40 million years ago, and that's when Antarctica was warm and had turtles.
Yeah.
So we're things are moving in a direction that we've really seen nothing like, and so, you know, you're going to talk about prediction. There's a certain point where it's kind of hard to know exactly what's going to happen because we're in a new place. We've never seen it before.
And interestingly enough, mostly, I guess, Sylvia, to the listeners and followers of what we do, and in some respects to what the council does, is that, okay, I really need to know the big picture, but I'm actually more interested in the little picture. So I think that what we're going to get is the value of the information that John's talking about in these reports. They get into the nuts and bolts by the council. I mean, you guys get these things, and now it's our job to explain it out to everybody that's in Mililii or in Makapu.
Right. So John is on our Marine Planning and Climate Change Committee, and also he gave a presentation at our last meeting in April. And one thing that came out of that is, having to look ahead. Like for the fishermen, one thing through presentations that John and others give, we realized that it's not only that the climate change affects the fish stocks, but also affects the catchability of those fish by fishermen, And so, they help us to say, well, what kind of data should we be monitoring? And so one of them that we're kind of maybe start adding is like the winds that aren't storms, but that might affect bottom fish fishermen. And also like rainfall that might affect a coolie fisherman, because there seems to be a link between rainfall and when the coolie are around. But another thing that we got from these presentations is like the need for long-term planning by government. Mm-hmm. And so one of the recommendations that came from the committee that then went to the council, and the council voted to agree to it, is for the harbors to see whether they have vulnerability studies, because one of the climate impacts is sea level rise and maybe less strong storms, but when they do come, they'll be stronger. And then if there's coral bleaching, there might be less coral to stop those impacts of the storm. So what the council has done is now written to all of the harbors in Hawaii and the Pacific territories to see if those studies have been done, and if they haven't, to recommend that they be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, this could boil down, if you're just driving by, when you note the vulnerability of it. We talk about this a lot of times with tsunami and hurricane and damaging airports and all of that stuff and harbors. I guess maybe in some respects, John, a lot of what you do when you say a harbor, that's the way we can get an immediate indicator what the hell is going on when the harbor's a foot higher than it used to be. Or there's a tide that all of a sudden crosses a bridge that's 50 feet above where it ever crossed before. So it's not as though that there weren't aha moments that can be gleaned from this. But in some respects, aren't we looking at being able to predict some stuff with a little more accuracy?
Yeah, the sea level, as far as fishing, I think the sea level's maybe been a bit of a sleeper. You don't think it would necessarily have an impact, but like Sylvia's alluded to, the ports and harbors might actually be a bit of the canary in the coal mine. We're looking at, it's not like all of a sudden the sea level is going to be up a foot. It's a little bit like the King Tide thing we had last year. You get a couple days where it's up high. And my understanding is that was one of the impacts, is things like the harbors started to feel a little bit of rollover of the bumpers, and stuff was sloshing around. And so, so before the land is inundated, the first thing that's going to come up is it's going to start to...
Because you can see it right there.
You're going to see it, but it's going to start to do things like roll up the moorings, if you have utilities that are under the decks.
Lifting up pipes.
it's gonna
spilling molasses all over the place.
Exactly, it's gonna start moving stuff around and shaking stuff around, and that's gonna be an impact. And it's not. It's what we're finding is the way the sea level works. Like I say, it's not just all of a sudden up a foot. It's like this year maybe we had 1 or 2 days. Well, 1 or 2 days a year.
Yeah.
20 or 30 years down the line, that's gonna be 1 or 2 days a month.
Yeah.
Well, that starts to all of a sudden be more than just all of a sudden be more than just a nuisance.
You know, here's something interesting, Sylvia. I know that it came up at the Maui meeting and others. We're talking about turtles. And, you know, maybe there's enough turtles where we can start eating a few of them every now and again down the road. But more importantly, didn't we just learn this within the last couple of weeks, that there are turtle breeding grounds that are so impacted by what we're talking about, is some of these turtles may not know where to go to have their babies. You know, that's part of the big picture, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I don't know. Turtles have survived extinctions, and humans haven't even been to one.
Yeah.
So I think the turtles might find where to go. I mean, there's other issues with turtles, like if there's the sand's hotter, they tend to come out off more females than males, you know, things like that. And then turtles is such a generic term because, you know, we have loggerhead turtles that come from Japan, pass through Hawaii to Mexico. We have leatherbacks that come from Indonesia, pass through Hawaii and go to, like, California. And
then we have our honu that doesn't seem to go much further outside the reef.
And our honu, from what the scientists tell us, you know, are just increasing, I think, maybe 7%. I mean, I would have to go back to our protected species advisor, but I think it's about 7%. And then they might have even reached the capacity of Hawaii.
I can tell you something. People might not want to hear this, but I know how good it tastes. I remember it when we used to catch turtle and sell them to the restaurants on Maui, on Front Street. Every restaurant had turtle steaks. Then we got politically correct about these little things, stopped eating them. And now they're all over the place. So somewhere there's a balance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I hear they're going up the canals. They're eating the limu that maybe herbivore fish need. And I think the problem with the turtles came when it became a commercial fishery. So did you want to say something, John?
I mean, there are issues with respect to, like, turtle nesting and seal haul out. You know, essentially the beach. And so if you lose the beach, you lose a place for them to do that part of their life cycle. So.
On that subject, interesting, John, just the other day, it looks like, you know, we have another monk seal birth about to happen to come on a beach. Rocky's pregnant again. And it just, you know, it interests all of us in the business, particularly to know that our seal population seems to be doing better in the main islands than it does in the reserve, where the apex predator, us, is not there. And it seems like they're suffering there because the sharks and the lure and other things. It must be very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in that field, so I can't really speak to that part of it. Mm-hmm.
However, I can tell you, if I think, Sylvie, what you're alluding to, and I agree with, I believe this 100% as a former, you know, fisher of turtles back in the day. And, I'm not embarrassed. I'm not admitting anything. We all did it. And then we all stopped because it became a rule that you had to stop. But I'm still thinking that, hey, wait a minute, you know, we have to make doggone sure before we say something in perpetuity that things may change and make it so it changes a little bit. And I agree with you. The turtles are pretty resourceful. If they can't go on that atoll anymore, they're going to find another. They're going to make one.
Right.
And maybe it might be at the Kaimana Beach, you know?
Right. And with the monk seals, I mean, we have the added... I think Noah's been bringing some of the monk seals down because of the situation up in the Northwesterns of them not the juveniles being a mass.
I was at the Waikiki Aquarium with Dr. Andy Rossiter just the other day, looking at the refurbished monk seal thing for this senior citizen seal that's there. It is pretty interesting, and I guess what John Mara was saying just a minute ago, and if you're just joining us, John Mara is a PhD, he's a scientist, he's the Regional Climate Services Director for the Pacific Region of NOAA and the National Centers for Environmental Information. And I guess maybe for those that don't know, I'm not sure how NOAA got backed into being the responsible person to crank out all of this science, but obviously it has to do with the big picture. And so this work that you do must vary from administration to administration and budget to budget is exactly how much can be done.
That's certainly the case. Mm-hmm. I think NOAA's got into this game, if you like, in part because a lot of the observing systems are NOAA. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's the folks that have the met stations through the meteorological stations, through the weather service. They have the buoys that measuring waves. They have the tide gauges. a lot of the satellites are NOAA and also NASA. So part of it is there. NOAA has been the entity since day one that's been collecting all this information. Yeah. And so they're in it because they're the source of a lot of the information that folks do analysis with.
Yeah, but see, now it's cool because a lot of us at the back in the day that wouldn't have even known about the information are not only knowing it but demanding because they need it. You know, right. They need it for what they're doing. I think what one of the things that might be also interesting is that, you know, one of the things that go about it, climate change, you mentioned, is over a longer period of time. And weather is like right now. I want people to get that so that when they look at the weather forecast on TV tonight, they can't say where they can go fish in a month, but your information might, or 2 months or 6 months.
Yeah, well, we can give things like, one, we can tell you what the average is so you know what the, you know, for example, I like to surf,
mm-hmm.
and July on the South Shore on average is a pretty good month.
Yeah.
But I can also look at and say, oh, it's an El Nino or La Nina year, and that might have some impact on whether this July is a good July or not a good July. And that same thing would apply to fishermen. You could kind of look at it and, you know, I can't tell you today that July, the Friday the 3rd, I couldn't tell you a month ago that Friday the 13th is going to be good, but I can give you some sense of, hey, July's probably a pretty good time.
That's good enough for me. I'm willing to roll the dice, Sylvia, and fill up the boat. I'm going.
Yeah, and also, John, I think NOAA has on the website for fishermen to go look at, more like longliners and people who go way out. There's a thing called Turtle Watch, which shows the North Pacific Subtropical Frontal Zone is, and that's tied to where the interactions might happen with the turtles, right? Yeah. And I think also a lot of data that is on our Safe Report now is available to the public, right, on the website?
Yes, and there's a lot of data. Again, I'm not great in the fishing side of it, but there's a lot of useful information in terms of currents, in terms of where the, you know, temperature gradients are. So if you're a fisherman and you're Akamai about where they like to sit, you can look at that information and kind of figure out where I want to go today.
The interesting thing to me, and we've talked about this before, as you know, Sylvia, part of what we do with the council segment of the Argo Fish program is every now and again I get the guys from Wicked Tuna to come on, and in the last few months we've had them a lot, and they're talking about their fishery is really a little bit more observant than ours is with regards to the number of fish they can catch. But aren't we the most watched of all? I mean, we have observers on all of our sword boats. I mean, they know when there's an interaction with them. They know about it.
Right, yeah. So on all of the longline vessels that shallow set for swordfish, 100%. Every trip, there's an observer on it. For the deep set longline fishery, it's 20% observer coverage.
That's still a lot. You never know, by the way, if you're a skipper, whether you're getting one or not this trip. But when you do, you have to accommodate them. And I think, haven't we sort of set an example, set the bar for other fisheries, other parts of the entire council? I mean, look at all of the things that in other parts of the Pacific, people are using what we're developing to keep their interactions low with turtles and bycatch.
Right. Yeah. Well, one thing our council did was we were the first one to use the vessel monitoring system.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be used for trucks, and we started using it on boats.
Yeah.
And now that's used globally, you know, that they put that on. And yeah, and there's a lot of other things that our council has pioneered, the ban on drift gill nets, the ban on bottom trawling. We did that throughout the U.S. EEZ and around Hawaii and the U.S. Pacific Islands, and now only other areas are just starting to do it on small patches.
You know, and I hate to bounce around, but the opportunity to have Dr. Maher or others like him on a regular basis sometimes a little tough. But I think this comes as a good idea when we said that, all right, let's say that you don't know what's going to happen in a month, but it's going to be, this is a likelihood of more of this or more of that this year because of this, which means when you talk about disaster preparation, some of the stuff that you've been doing and cranking out is going to give people, you know, November of this year might be a bad year. So if we have stuff in place that we think we have enough stuff, we may not. Let's take a look at this month before we need it.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the classic example of that is the hurricane season outlook that the Weather Service puts together, I think, every April, and that's the sort to give you advance warning.
How many we should expect.
And so you can prepare ahead of time and you're aware of it. And so there's similar sorts of information this way.
You know, I know that the scientific world would probably look at it a different way, but there's some that are saying, you know, Hawaii, you know, Keakua decided where these islands were going to be because 99% of the time, all these devastating storms just go and they go around us. Every now and again, Hurricane Eva and Iniki in 82 and 92, we didn't get so lucky. But isn't it amazing for people in your business to say, you know, it doesn't take much of a little glitch or a little whoop for something to happen, but we've been, knock on wood, we've been lucky for a long time.
Yeah, a lot of what we do is the odds, it's probabilities. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, like the 100 year, the 1% storm, the 100 year storm doesn't mean it's going to be, on average, it's once in every 100 years.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean it can't happen in next year.
I think, though, that where it becomes gratifying, Sylvia, to the council and certainly all of the volunteers and all the participatory agencies, to see the information that's being produced actually used, whether it's used by a long-line guy or a teacher in a classroom to sort of explain things. So to depoliticize what seems to be happening with the Earth, we hope.
Yeah, right. And we try to put a lot of outreach materials on our website so that teachers can download it. And I'm just getting ready to put up a lot of packages. Teachers are meeting in about 2 weekends from now. So we'd like them to use it. We would like them, students, and also fishermen to start to understand more what's happening with the changing climate. And to get familiar with the terms so that as we move into the future, they're kind of aware and prepared.
What you need to do is you need to make WPCouncil.org put it on your favorites list. And just check it every now and again, especially those of you that are teachers, because I want to particularly thank Mary, who teaches at a private girls' school, who said that she went to the website and was able to secure tools and materials at no cost so that they could do some specials in the ocean. It must really make those of you in the office pleased when somebody finds out about you and says, I want to make this project. What can you do to help me?
Right, and they can email us too. A lot of the teachers like our lunar calendars, and also we have a high school summer course, and we've had teacher workshops in the past. I mean, if there's a need, and enough teachers are interested, we put those on also.
Yeah, and by the way, every time we have one of those, and whether it's the students or the teachers, it's a big learning curve. I still don't think, though, since we have John Meyer here, you gave a presentation at the council's marine planning and climate change committee, and that led to a recommendation that the council find out if harbor vulnerability studies have been done for Hawaii and what that actually means. I mean, I'm assuming that there's some data collection way to do some of this stuff. How do we go back historically to create what has happened and what could happen?
Well, a couple different ways. One is, like I said, you can just look at the observations. And so for sea level, you can, you know, look at a tide gauge and you can basically measure the trend.
Mm-hmm. We're starting to collect more of that, I believe.
We have Hawaii has the tide gauge in Honolulu is one of the longest records out there. It's over 100 years. So you can look at what it's just been doing. And then we also can apply what you would call a model or basically some of the basic physics. We know that when you heat up water, it expands. Mm-hmm. We know that when you heat the air, it melts ice, and that a certain volume of ice of water goes into the ocean. And so, you know, you can do analysis to, you're talking about prediction now, besides just the natural trend, you can do analysis that tell you, okay, well, it's going to get, you know, the sea level is going to go up this much because of these added contributions. And there's other little things that happen along the way, but that's the basis for some of this prediction. And similarly, now the satellite record's long enough that you can be tracking the satellite record.
Yeah, and that's incredibly interesting because, I mean, I don't want to date any of us, but, you know, none of us have been on the planet before this technology. And in our business, like you said when you came in here, what's happened in a broadcast studio is a little bit different than in the old days. It must be very true for what you do, too, is with regards to technology and the availability of it to help you out.
Yeah, it's huge. Not on the sophistication of the observing systems, but also even the ability to analyze data and run some of these models, the models to look at different versions of climate change, the models that are predicting the weather we have. Massive improvements. And that's starting to bring down, maybe that's, you know, a word that comes out a lot in climate change is this, or, you know, is the word uncertainty.
Yeah.
And
thing is it's uncertain.
Well, say to some folks, you know, death has a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah.
I don't know when it's going to happen.
But it's going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah, so from our perspective, we throw that word out, but we don't, uncertainty doesn't mean doubt. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an important point. And so we're with this new information, we're able to reduce that uncertainty and begin to get a better handle on, you know, is sea level going to be, you know, a foot higher or 2 feet higher or 3 feet higher? And we're starting to kind of, this additional information and more sophisticated analysis is beginning to narrow that down. And that's, to get to your point, you really need to have pretty specific information for a particular location.
I was going to say, you know,
if you're going to do anything with it, to say the global sea level rise is going to be a foot you know, 20, 30 years, that doesn't help me if I'm at a particular location.
Yeah, and that's why I think it, and there must have been some aha moments. Could you tell when you were making your presentation what was hitting home and what was, excuse me, I'm going to take a nap while you go through that part. I just want to know where my coolie is.
Well, I probably took a nap through the whole thing.
I don't think so.
You know, I think, I mean, because the council picked up on the harbor issue, I think that the sea level had not typically been the potential impact of sea level rise on the fishing industry from the standpoint of impacts to harbors. I don't think that necessarily had been, they may have been a little bit of a light bulb. Other stuff that's a little bit more subtle, you know, we talk, you're seeing some of the heat waves that have been happening on the lately in the on the mainland, and you're going to see the same thing out here, and that it's going to be hotter and it's going to be muggier because more heat in the air means more moisture. So, you know, little things like, it's probably not going to be very fun on some of these on deck and on the dock, because it's going to be a lot more hotter days, muggier days, and those sort of things like that. They're like, oh, I hadn't really thought about that. But that's something, you know, from a fisherman's standpoint.
But you know what's kind of funny, and Sylvia, I don't know if you've heard this. I'm sure you have, because parts of the rest of the breadth of the council, that there are significantly higher in different tides. Here in Hawaii, we're kind of lucky. You know, high tide, low tide. One guy says, I know when it's high tide because the rock's sticking up. And I know when it's low tide. I mean, you know, when it's low tide, the rock's sticking up. It's high tide with the rock. But the rock's only a foot. You know, I mean, so we really don't have the dramatic seesaw that a lot of other places do, right? And they need to know these things.
Yeah, that's correct. Again, it depends where you are. If you're along the, typically along the equator, you don't have a big tide range.
Right.
If you get up to places like Oregon.
Up a foot, down a foot.
We're talking plus or minus 10 feet. And that's relevant in the sea level thing, too, because if you're someplace like the Oregon coast where you have a 10-foot of tide happening all the time, an extra foot isn't as big a deal as it is in Hawaii, where you're only talking about 1 or 2 feet. So that extra foot is a big, big difference.
You know, you mentioned earlier, and Sylvia and I, our ears both went up, when you said king tides, because what happened? They stopped talking about them. From what I understand, there's a couple coming up this month that are king tides.
Yeah, it's an interesting, technically the king, there is only one king tide. And for Hawaii, that's that sort of December, you know, they're tied to they're basically the biggest
moon,
tide of the year. Yeah. So it's in, you know, it's the winter's, solstice. And so, but what's kind of happened is it's meant, we've used the word king tides to kind of represent the highest seasonal or basically any time it gets higher. So we didn't start, we've had a relatively high tide just this last June because we had the summer solstice, and we're going to have another one in December. But well, it's different than what we had back in a year or so back when there was the king tides, quote unquote, all over the TV. Is we had those normal seasonal tides, but we also had some other things, like we had eddies that came along and bumped up this elevation by 10 or 20 centimeters. We had some latent El Nino effects that bumped it up. So you had a whole bunch of things. We talked about the 100-year storm. You had a whole bunch of things that just happened to kind of coincide, as well as some soil at the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, big variation in the waves too, surfer.
We felt that everything just kind of was the perfect storm, so to speak. And so we saw the impacts much more dramatically than we would on sort of a normal king tide.
You know, Sylvia, what I mean, obviously we have to get together with John Maher some more. But I mean, I think that if we can get anybody to understand, they go to WPCouncil.org, they look at the big picture, they go through these, you know, these well-illustrated and documented reports that are out there. And if they just get one little gem that they can use, our mission is completed, right? I mean, if somebody says, I'm not gonna go fish and waste fuel in January this year, because it doesn't make sense. I'm going to wait till March.
Right. And also, we want to hear from the fishermen, too. So, like, the last time we talked was about our climate training. And we wanted to take that out to the fishing community. Mm-hmm. But we realized that people, our advisors, even people in our Marine Planning and Climate Change Committee, not all of them are really feel comfortable with all the terminology and sure. concepts. So we ended up training our advisors first. But we would like to hear from the fishermen to see if we are like monitoring the things that they feel yeah, from being yeah, in the water all sure. the time, yeah. that are the weather and yeah. climate things that are important yeah. to their fishery. So that's one thing. And also, I just wanted to throw out, you know, we've kind of talked about all of like the key climate things that we're monitoring, except for ocean acidification. That's another another thing that we're monitoring. And I don't know if John wants
you know,
to
say and John, it. That's an interesting point. A couple of programs ago, we had this Mike Kim from the New Hope Church out in Hawaii Kai, and they do the little keiki fishing tournament every year. It's a tag and release, I mean, a release tournament. And everybody agrees, Manalua Bay, when you drive by there, it's this pristine piece of ocean. You see this nice, especially on a nice Malia day, with, but you don't know what's going on, you know, underneath there. This is what we're talking about, right?
Right.
It's just totally, sometimes you just don't understand how bad something is because you don't know what to look for.
Yeah, well, and the ocean acidification isn't something yeah. you're going to see. Just like we talked about more carbon dioxide, CO2, in the atmosphere, yeah. you're also getting more carbon dioxide in the ocean. And that changes.
Under the water, sure.
But in the water, yeah, and it changes yeah. the chemistry. And that yeah. has potential, real potential implications to fisheries because the plankton that make the little creatures that the fish eat that make the little carbonate shells in the reef, for that matter, the more acidic it gets, the less likely or the less able they are to make shells. And so, you know, if you collapse that part of the food chain, you got some serious problems.
Sure. And then you also have an issue, Sylvia, where this came up with the boat guys, that a lot of the charter divers and a lot of the the commercial divers, they're throwing their hook. They're throwing their anchors in these places all the time, you know. And some of these places say, please don't anchor here. We need a year to recover. You know, we don't want to get all busted up. So maybe some of that is our valuable tools, too.
Yeah, they are. And the council's jurisdiction is 3 to 200 miles, yeah, and 0 to 3 is the state. Although we work together, and the fish don't know that 3-mile boundary, and neither do fishermen. So
yeah, and that's a great way to sort of to end today's get-together. I certainly hope, seriously, Dr. John Meyer, that we can see you again, because what you've been doing is enlightening. And Sylvia, I want to thank you for arranging it. And also, if people want to know more, where they can go to get this information?
Well, they can go to wppcouncil.org for us, and then they can also go to NOAA website.
Yeah, and NOAA's website?
Yes.
Just Google NOAA.
Exactly. Yeah. I think NOAA.gov/fisheries. NOAA.gov will get you into the whole spectrum of weather stuff and fisheries and everything else that we do.
Okay, if you want to know more about that, drop me an email. It's easy. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. TheMikeBuckShow@gmail.com. Our thanks to Ron Hill for the wrap up of the Hale Iwa tournament. And we talk HIBT next time. Also, the Wahine Senior Tournament over there in Kona. Have a great rest of your weekend. And remember, wpcouncil.org if you want to find out more about this great stuff. More next time. See ya.